At Keeley Companies, it is no secret that they believe in the power of people. In an effort to help their Keeleyans get to know each other a little bit better, they decided to launch the Who Do You Know campaign. The goal was simple. Keeleyans were encouraged to have a conversation with someone outside of their circle. That's it. These conversations, however, have brought people together and furthered their world-class culture. Shout out to the Keeleyans who have made an effort to have meaningful conversations with new friends. You can learn more about those conversations, about those amazing friends, by visiting them online at KeeleyCompanies.com.
Welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. John is the number one national best-selling author of the book On Fire. He's a world-class inspirational speaker, and he's the host of the Live Inspired podcast. John interviews extraordinary individuals on their life story so that you can wake up from accidental living and more fully live your life story. Here's your host, John O'Leary.
Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. Get your passport ready. You're going to need it during this episode because we are going to go on a wild traveling trip around the world with an incredible human being and a guy who I'm really lucky enough to call a friend. His name is Sam Goodwin. Sam is an entrepreneur. He's an author. He's a thought leader on embracing uncertainty and the resilience of the human spirit. Today, during our episode, Sam details his epic journey of traveling to all 193 UN-recognized sovereign states, being wrongfully imprisoned on false charges of espionage in Syria in 2019, how connections and coincidences and faith were central to his release, and the lessons that he has learned in the process. My friends, this is a remarkable conversation. It's going to reveal the miraculous potential for love to liberate us from our most isolating and our most agonizing of situations. So buckle up, get your passport ready, grab your favorite Live Inspired journal and pen as I bring on my friend and soon to be yours. His name is Sam Goodwin. Sam, welcome to Live Inspired with John O'Leary.
John, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I say this a lot to my guests when they're on, like, it's nice to have a friend on board. And that is frequently true. But in this case, it's sincerely true. I've known your story for a long while, and I can't wait to hear the response from our listeners and viewers when they get to know your story. So, Sam, for the folks who don't know you quite as well as I do, if they were to bump into you in an airport, at a coffee shop, at a bar, and they say, Sam, tell me about you, how do you respond to that?
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Well, I, like you, from St. Louis, grew up in the Midwest and spent a lot of my upbringing playing competitive hockey. I was fortunate to have a little bit of success with the sport and played in college, played Division I at Niagara University. And after college, I had the opportunity to go overseas. I moved to Singapore and I planned to only be there for about 3 months, but I ended up staying for 6 years. And it was a great way to begin my professional career. I was working for a tech startup business and an NGO. But throughout that time living overseas, I traveled quite a bit. And over about a 10-year period, I traveled every country in the world, and super grateful for those experiences and the perspectives. But I've learned at the time only about 100 people in history who had ever been to every country in the world. So was kind of part of a small club and great experiences. So that's something that I may also come up, and my travel experience was a fantastic journey and something I wouldn't trade for anything. But like any worthwhile venture or endeavor in life, it wasn't without its challenges. And perhaps most notably in 2019, I was in Syria, and the regime, they took me hostage. They accused me of being an American spy and collaborating with terrorists, and things got pretty uncomfortable. But thank God, thanks to a long list of people who worked tirelessly and ended peacefully.
I mean, man, you just gave us a quick preview of a life well lived. We heard about family in the Midwest and hockey in Niagara and Singapore and traveling to every nation in the world, including a nation called Syria, and a little bit of time there as a hostage. That is a lot to share at a coffee shop with a stranger. But we're going to slowly unpack those stories and make sure that as you leave this episode, you're no longer a stranger, that you're going to leave as a friend, and people are going to feel the same way about you that I do, which is someone that they look up to. It's a great story, man. which means there are some challenges along the way and some redemptive moments. We'll talk about both. I want to start back in the Midwest, though. You have, like I, a pretty big family. I think you're one of five.
Yep, that's right. The oldest of five.
What was the madness of the Goodwin family like for you growing up?
It was definitely madness. So there's five of us in 7 years. So we were all scrunched together. It was like rapid fire for my parents. But it's interesting now because I think about being very close in age as kind of this chaotic situation when we were kids. But now as adults, it's fantastic because we're all close in age and we're all kind of at similar stages in life. So it was crazy as kids, but it's really evolved into a great thing now as adults.
Why hockey?
So it's funny, my dad played hockey just a little bit casually in high school. And I think he always thought maybe he would have his kids play hockey. However, it was actually, I was playing kindergarten soccer and my mom was talking to one of the other moms and she said, I'm going to put my son in hockey. And my mom said, oh yeah, I might do that in a few years. And that mom said, well, if you want them to be any good, they have to start early. So she said, okay, then maybe I will. And so she signed me up separate from my dad. It would have been kind of expected for my dad to assign me up. And then it became, you know, a big part of our lives.
As if this mother of five, all of them seven and under, doesn't have enough that she's already sprinted around to the minivan pursuing. She signs you for hockey. It becomes full-time. You become blessed and gifted in it, man. You excel at it. You play in high school. And you get an opportunity of ultimately playing in college. Talk about Niagara.
Played growing up in St. Louis, played through the youth programs in St. Louis, was fortunate to be coached by a lot of the ex-Blues players who have stuck around and really played a huge role in developing the minor hockey scene in St. Louis. Went on to play in college at Niagara and enjoyed all of the things that being a student athlete has to offer. And really enjoyed my time at Niagara. It's a long winter in upstate New York. There's a lot of snow, but it's hockey weather, I guess. But interestingly, my senior year, I had a bad concussion injury. And I had fought similar injuries throughout my playing career, but this one was different. I had post-concussion syndrome for about 8 months and had a headache every day. And those didn't end up subsiding until after graduation. And that was kind of an inflection point because throughout my entire life, I had really only thought about playing hockey. I wanted to play professionally. It's really what I had put all of my time and energy into. And at the time, I wasn't sure what I was going to do because a lot of the doctors told me that pursuing it and another hit could lead to permanent damage to my brain. And so it wasn't potentially a healthy decision to continue doing that. Like many other early 20-year-olds, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I started reaching out and ended up through some networking, had an opportunity to go overseas for an internship. And that led to so many incredible things. But the reason that I mention this is because when I reflect back, it was just this classic situation of when one door closes, another one opens. A cliche saying, but it was so true. And if that doesn't happen, then, you know, some of the other things that, you know, feel fortunate for all these experiences that have happened as a result, none of that happens if there's not this challenge and this thing taken from me, but as a result, other things provided.
So you end up working post-college in Singapore, which I've been to one time and is a world away from anything you've experienced in the United States. It's just a completely different community and pace and culture. And you're there. And on the weekends, you would start traveling. Where would be a couple places you would go in the early stages of your work over there?
Yep. So I was working for a tech company doing business development, investor relations, and it was a startup company. So had like a little bit of flexibility in my work schedule. And also Singapore, it's the heart of Southeast Asia. It has the world's best airport. It's a really great place to be based and a great way to begin my professional career. From a travel standpoint, it's in the heart of this region. So it would be Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines. And just a personal preference, when I traveled, I didn't like to repeat places. So even if I went somewhere and had a fantastic experience the next weekend or holiday, I would just go somewhere different. And I put this formula into play for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And it was in early 2018 when I realized I had been to about 120 countries in the world. And I just remember at that point thinking, well, how many are there? I always travel because it was fun and I enjoyed it. But most importantly, I learned from it. Travel was the best education I'd ever had. And
before I ask this question, I'm going to have the kids at home get ready to write it down in their pencils and crayons. Kids, write down how many countries there are. And Professor Goodwin's about to give us the actual answer. But Sam, how many countries are there? You went to 120. How many more were there?
So there are 193 fully recognized UN sovereign states. And there are a few different lists. If you get into like the Olympics and FIFA and different things, slightly different numbers, but 193 UN states. And so that was the number that I ended up using.
So you've crossed off 120 by accident, just by pursuing the next adventure, the next adventure, the next adventure. And then you make a decision. Well, gosh, I'm more than halfway there. Let's get this thing done. And you just start exploring the world. I'm going to go through a couple countries, and whether it's the experience that you did, something beautiful geographically you saw, something you ate, or just the people you visited with, I'd love to hear what it was like for you to visit this place. Nearby to where you were, Thailand.
Thailand, some of the best beaches in the world, and also Southeast Asia in general, the dollar goes a long way. There's so much that can be done for a small amount of money.
In an unusual country, which very few Westerners have visited, North Korea.
Yep, I went to North Korea in 2016. I was invited there to coach their national hockey team. It's probably the place that I get asked about the most or towards the top of the list. And I'll just say that I'm not oblivious to the fact that I saw what they wanted me to see. And getting off that kind of tourist track, things can look a little different. But I had a fantastic experience, and it's a real incredible experience to use sports, for example, as a way to build a cultural bridge. Mm.
New Zealand. It's on my list to it. Someday see, I've not yet seen it. So what was your experience in New Zealand?
I think New Zealand is the most naturally beautiful place in the world. I did a road trip in the South Island over Christmas in 2014, and around each bend is another postcard. It's worth every second of travel that's required to get to its corner of the world.
So you and I are recording this in the afternoon. Earlier today, I had the opportunity of speaking at an event, and there was a lady that I met from Russia, and then a lady about four behind her from Ukraine. So I'd love to hear what your experience in Russia was like.
I've only been to Russia once. I went to the Olympics in 2014 in Sochi, but spent a couple of days in Moscow beforehand and then went down to Sochi and had a great experience there. Saw the U.S. hockey team play.
And then what about Ukraine?
Ukraine, I went in January of 2018. And if any Ukrainians are listening, I remember going to this restaurant in the middle of Kiev that required a password to get in. And a friend had given me the password, and it was this very cool restaurant. It was called The Last Barricade. It's underneath a building in the town square, and just really incredible food. Mm.
Peru.
It's hard to mention Peru without talking about Machu Picchu. It's a wonder of the world, an incredible place to visit. There's a lot of other things there, too, that are great, but Machu Picchu is probably the place to see.
I have three more to ask. The first, the smallest country I've ever visited, Luxembourg. How was Luxembourg?
Luxembourg. I did a day trip from Luxembourg from France. It's similar to the countries around it, but definitely worth seeing if you're in the area.
The next two are going to be Iraq and then Syria. But before I ask you about those two, I think many of our listeners are probably thinking to themselves, how in the world did this dude get to all these places? How wealthy is his father and mother? How entitled is this kid? And I think you should speak to that right now. So how did you travel to all these countries financially?
Yeah, it's one of the questions that I get quite a bit. How the hell did you fund all this? And for me, travel was the priority in my life. It's really what I cared about. I loved that developing a deeper understanding of the world. And I pursued it. The anecdote that I often share when I'm asked about this is I remember it was 2016. I was in Singapore and I was going to get some food for lunch. And I would often go to these, they're called hawker stalls in Singapore. And I would get chicken rice, for example, which it costs about the equivalent of like $4 US for a lunch. And it was a decent amount of food. And the lady who was serving it to me, she asked me if I wanted extra chicken. And I thought about it for a second. She said it was going to be the equivalent of like 50 cents for the extra chicken. And I thought about it. I wasn't sure. And I said, you know what? No, I'm going to save my money and I'm not going to do it. Like 2 hours later, I was back at my apartment and I was planning this trip, this weekend trip to Bhutan, which is a mountainous country in Asia. And it's notoriously expensive for different reasons. Visas are expensive. And it was going to be like $3,500 for a weekend, which was insane. And I said, yep, I'm 100% in. I'm going to go. And this was right after I didn't spend 50 cents. So it was really just about prioritizing it. That was just what I did. That was what I focused on. And I was always working full time up until the last couple months. But that was just what I prioritized.
I like having friends with me when I'm traveling. So when I travel for work, if I'm by myself, I find myself working in the lobby or nearby, almost like within view of safety. I guess I'm a bit risk averse when I'm on the road, unless I have a partner with me. It seems to me like much of the travel you were doing, you were by yourself.
So I did arrange, did a decent amount of solo travel, but also traveled with people, family, friends, other travelers that I had met. And I really enjoyed both of them, both styles of travel. On one hand, it's great to be able to do what you want, when you want, how you want to do it. On the other hand, there's nothing like sharing those moments of discovery with other people, particularly people you care about. Pros and cons to both. And I did a range of both.
What was a country that you went to because it was one of the 193 that you had to check off that list that you really weren't excited about? But then as you experienced it, you're like, oh my gosh, this place is awesome.
Yeah, gosh, that I'll say there are people who travel a lot for work and they still aren't going to end up, you're not going to end up going to all of them. There has to be like this special effort for some of them, whether it's like rural Africa or South Pacific specifically. There were quite a few places that I think are maybe underrated. Like Taiwan comes to mind, even though that's actually not one of the 193, but that was a place that I didn't, I guess my expectations weren't super high, but that ended up being a very naturally beautiful place and incredible food. Din Tai Fung started there. It just incredible. And actually this country will probably come up later in the conversation, but Lebanon was also a place where just didn't really have high expectations. And that proved to be a place, not just because the Lebanese saved my life, but even before that, a place that naturally beautiful, incredible history, incredible food, and just a great vibe and have some political instability right now. But I'm very hopeful for Lebanon.
Well, let's move toward that part of the map right now. You eventually make your way to Iraq.
I've been to Iraq a few times, and particularly the north in Kurdistan and in Erbil is where I've had many of my best travel experiences. I think some of the best hospitality in the world is across the Middle East. It's some of the most religiously, historically, culturally significant places in the world. My time in Iraq, particularly in Kurdistan with the Kurds, has been really positive.
You make your way eventually into Syria. And this is when your story goes from getting your passport checked. Life is good. You might get stomach aches from now, from time and again, but you're moving forward in the journey and you're about to have your entire life derailed profoundly. So I'm going to let you kind of pick it up from there.
On May 25th, 2019, I went across from Iraq into the northeast region of Syria. As you mentioned, kind of getting a passport stamped on both sides, going through, doing all of the logistical steps. I went to Qamishli, and just 2 hours after arriving, I was walking through a roundabout on the way to meet up with my guide when all of a sudden these men and a black pickup truck abruptly pulled up next to me. Two of them jumped out of the truck and instructed me to get inside. And thankfully, they weren't violent, but I didn't have a choice. I was scared, confused. I had no information. Anyone to help was desperately trying to understand what was happening. And as we sped down back alleys of the city, the officers in the vehicle told me that they were skeptical about my travel history, my travel motives, and they accused me of espionage, of being an American spy and collaborating with terrorists. And nothing like this had ever happened to me before.
To remind our viewers and listeners what's happening in Syria, not only now, but in 2019, what's the structure of the country like in 2019?
Since 2011, when the Arab Spring reached Syria, the country has been experiencing a brutal, decades-long civil war. More than half a million people have died in the conflict, estimated. The UN stopped counting at 250,000. Interestingly, one of the most significant things that I had learned through my travels is that places that are negatively perceived or that Western media tells us we're not supposed to like, these were places where I had many of my best experiences and where my perspectives were most meaningfully impacted. So despite everything that was happening and much of that conflict by 2019 had subsided and was kind of pushed to a different part of the country, but despite that perception, I was confident that the same would be the case in Syria as it had been in every other place around the world.
And in so many regards, you're right. The people that you've met to that point, the first 2 hours, and then you'll meet for the days, weeks, and months to come, for the most part, represent the best of humanity. Tragically, they are beat down by the worst of humanity. So let's talk about this. You're hurtling down in an SUV with armed guards, now unaware of where you're going or why you're going there. What happens next?
A couple minutes later, one of the officers in the vehicle, he reached into his pocket and he pulled out a blindfold and he put it over my eyes. And just a few seconds later, the truck stopped and they took me out and they took the blindfold off and I looked up and I was underneath a huge Syrian military airplane out in the tarmac of an airport. They handcuffed me behind my back, took me over to the ladder, and threw me into the cargo hold of the plane. About 30 minutes later, the plane took off. A question I sometimes like to ask in the wake of this whole story is how often have you been flying on an airplane and not known where the plane is going? And that was the situation I found myself in. And this just overwhelming, you know, uncertainty was beginning to grow around me.
We're going to come back to this question I'm going to ask you now, and we'll probably come back to it several more times. But what do you do in that kind of moment when you are blindfolded under armed guard in Syria, now in the belly of an airplane, going to a place you don't even know where or why you're heading there?
I really fought to stay calm, which was a real challenge. I tried to just remind myself that I had been in situations before where things got uncomfortable, nothing like this, but they had kind of stayed calm and they'd resolved themselves. And I believed that playing the angry tourist or something like that wasn't going to do me any favor. So I tried to remain calm and actually did so rather effectively, but I knew that this was different.
You end up landing, you end up entering a prison system. You'll learn more about that in the weeks to come. Why don't you tell our listeners where you are?
So after getting to Damascus, was taken into the center of town, into the basement of a facility that I now know is called Syria's Military Intelligence Prison Number 215, this facility that's notoriously known for housing political prisoners. And I remember the officer in charge, he spoke a little bit of English and he escorted me to a cell in the back of the basement. And when he put me in there, I remember he went to the inside of the cell door and he said, "Food, water, toilet, knock. Otherwise, quiet, no talking." and he slammed the door and left. And I was stunned. I was in disbelief about what had happened in just a few short hours. My life had spiraled out of control in the most terrifying of ways. Frankly, John, I felt exactly the way they wanted me to. Hopeless, utterly cut off from any control of my life. And I went on to remain here in solitary confinement for 27 days. The only human interaction I had was for a few seconds in the morning and in the evening when the guards brought bread and boiled potatoes and water.
And that's only partially true, because there was another human interaction you experienced, which was the cries and the screams from your fellow prisoners. You know, man, it's got to be hard to relive all this. But although you weren't personally tortured, the people next to you on both sides and all throughout this prison were being tortured. What is it like being cut off, unsure of where you are, if anyone's coming for you, if anyone's even aware that you're missing or where you might be, and listening to people, human beings, being tortured?
As you meant, during this time, I was never physically harmed, but the facility was not soundproof. And every day I would hear the sounds of these inmates being beaten and tortured. And of course, I couldn't help but wonder, when's my turn? Essentially, I realized that I was in this environment where nothing was off limits. And I never stopped caring about, you know, dying or the long list of other bad things that I thought might happen. But I began to lose the energy to be afraid. Because fear is an emotion, and it takes energy to generate that emotion. And I was so exhausted that I was losing the energy to even generate the emotion as time went on. But one of the things that I talk a decent amount about with this situation, if I told you, like, John, if I told you that right now you're going to sit in a dungeon, a cement dungeon, for the next 27 days, and you're going to be given bread and boiled potatoes and water. And on day 27, people are going to come in, they're going to take you out, and you're going to kind of move on to the next step of the process and go home. I'm not saying that you'd be comfortable, but you would be okay because you have the time. What changed the entire situation and kind of answering your question was the uncertainty of the situation. Based on the information that I had, I believed that all these potential scenarios were possible. For example, was I going to be released in 5 minutes? Based on the information that I had, I thought that was possible. Was I going to be in this dungeon forever? I thought that was possible. Would I be released in a week? Were they going to torture me or just shoot me or stop feeding me? Based on the information I had, I believed that these were all possible, and attempting to entertain all of these possible outcomes 24/7 was emotionally and psychologically exhausting.
You've said to me over coffee that prisoners count down, hostages count up, and there's no end in sight when you're counting up. It just until infinity and beyond, says Buzz.
Exactly. Right? We think about in movies, we see the scenes where they're making tallies and you have a calendar and counting down the days. But I had my own calendar, but it was, as you said, going to infinity.
What keeps a guy who doesn't speak the language of his prison guards or the other folks around him, doesn't know if his family knows, doesn't get to have any say at all on anything at all anymore? What keeps you going? Where are you drawing your inspiration and encouragement?
During this time, I found strength in several ways. For example, I leaned on perspectives that I had developed from traveling to different corners of the world, which provoked gratitude for just the basic food and water that I was given. I leaned quite a bit on skills and traits I developed from being a competitive athlete, the mental toughness, critical thinking, resilience. How often have we had a boss or a coach tell us, control what you can control? I leaned on a belief that I had a purpose in life and a desire to see family and friends again. There are three key things that I reflect on. One was a bit paradoxical. I found a lot of strength in actually leaning into gratitude. Everything had been taken from me, but I remember having this conversation with myself and thinking, like, okay, maybe there's some positivity here, and having this fight with the inner self, and the inner voice is saying, you know, are you crazy? There's nothing positive here. There's nothing to be grateful for. The best this will ever be is a period of your life you can forget. But as I leaned into gratitude, I realized I can be grateful for my health, my education, the food and water I'm being given. I'm grateful that the guard who just delivered me a boiled potato smiled at me for 1 second. These things may sound elementary or insignificant, but I found that each one of these small expressions of gratitude became a silent rebellion against the uncertainty of the situation.
From one of your speeches, you use this quote that we're never less alone than when we are totally alone with God.
In addition to leaning on perspectives that I had developed from traveling and skills and traits from being an athlete and gratitude, there was nothing in that cell that was more important to me than my faith. Everything had been taken from me, my material possessions, my communication, my freedom. But no matter what, I knew that my faith was absolute. And my prayers became an uninterrupted conversation with God. I was constantly talking to him, sometimes pissed off, pacing back and forth. And I would say things out loud, even though they told me not to talk. I said, God, I'm here. I'm listening. What are you trying to tell me today? What can I learn today? What are perhaps the positives about my situation today? And I remember kind of breaking down my prayers into a few different categories, but the first, my number one prayer was always, God, please keep the situation safe and peaceful. Please keep me physically unharmed. The second prayer was then about the timeline. So if this was all going then peacefully, then my next question was when? And this was the prayer that for me became the most tricky and intense. And I remember almost positioning it as like a business deal. I said, God, I know you have a plan, but is it possible? Would you consider an adjustment to the timeline? Can that work with your plan? And then the last thing that I remember doing was I would pray the rosary, and I would dedicate each decade to something different. I'd pray for my family, my friends, anybody who I thought might be working to get me out of the situation. And I remember praying very hard for the courage to forgive my captors. And through that, I discovered that I was working to forgive people who weren't even sorry. And that's real strength. Forgiveness is not a feeling. It's a choice. But I found a lot of strength through forgiveness. So my faith was a big part of this journey. And to your point, the line that you mentioned, during this time, I felt this closeness to God that I had never felt before. And to be frank with you, in the wake of this situation, I've had a tough time replicating that, even though I feel like I tasted something really right. special. And I think that speaks to a lot of the distractions and phones and everything in our lives today. It's been hard to replicate that. I often try to challenge people, think about the time when they felt the closest to God and what would it take to replicate that today.
You spend almost a full month in solitary confinement, and it doesn't end then. It continues on for another month after that, June 22nd, 2019. What happens then?
It was day 27. I was taken out of solitary confinement and taken across town to a facility called ADRA, which is the country's central federal prison. I was put in a cell with about 40 other men and remained here for the next 35 days for another month.
I got to jump in. That sounds like a recipe for your disaster. An American, Christian, Catholic kid in the wrong place at the wrong time. It seems like this would be the most dangerous. Like, you would have been far better off back in solitary confinement.
I thought that too. When I got there, perhaps a bit paradoxically, or what we might imagine, the other inmates became friends. We cooked and shared food together. They taught me Arabic. I taught them English. There was a prison basketball court, and I taught several of them how to play knockout. One of them even smuggled a note out of the prison, a note that successfully navigated this game of geopolitical telephone and made it to my father in St. Louis and served as the first time I managed to communicate that I was alive. And these men truly risked their life to help save my life, and where they were a remarkable display of humanity. And one of the key things that I remember is a couple weeks in, I asked one of the men who had become my friend, I said, you know, everyone here is being so nice to me. It's kind of hard to know what to expect here. And I'll never forget, he said, Sam, in Syria, all the good people are here in prison because all the bad people are outside putting us in here. And that's something that really resonated with me, with the way that sometimes these authoritarian regimes can operate, and the way that the heartbreaking situation that Syria is experiencing right now.
So you're playing knockout with Syrians in a prison. I mean, this is your life. It's an unbelievable reality now, one that you're going to deal with for about a month. How does life change for you on July 26th?
One of the prison officials came to the cell I was in. He called my name and he indicated that I was being moved. As he was walking me out to the front, he stopped and he said, Sam, you're very lucky. President Assad has agreed to release you. This was encouraging, but I had been lied to so many times in the past 2 months through all this that I had kind of become immune to believing anything like this. But outside, I was put into a black SUV, and this turned out to be part of a 5-vehicle convoy that raced out of Damascus, what seemed to be 100 miles an hour. You know, we didn't stop at traffic lights. We used the shoulder of the road to maneuver around traffic. We drove west towards the mountains, and nobody in the vehicle was talking. Nobody said a word. And the nice cars and the professional kind of nature of the operation, it made me think that this was either really good or really bad. You know, I'm about to experience kind of one extreme of the captivity spectrum here, but I didn't know which one it was. And we came up to this checkpoint. It seemed to be some kind of significant border. And as we passed through, the officer in the vehicle sitting next to me, he tapped me on the leg kind of subtly. He said, Sam, you're in Lebanon. You're safe now. Mm. I was still kind of figuring out everything that was happening, but that was certainly encouraging.
The closest experience I've ever had to the question I'm about to ask you is when I was in the hospital by myself as a 9-year-old. Unsure if I was going to live or die. And my dad walks in, and right behind my dad comes my mom. And even though we were still panic struck physically by what had happened to me in the fire, knowing that I was with them made me feel safe for the first time since the explosion. Now, your timeline isn't hours like mine was from explosion to seeing mom and dad. It was months. What was it like for you in Lebanon getting out of that SUV and for the first time seeing your mom and dad?
It was taken into Beirut, taken to the office of Lebanon's internal security. It's kind of like the equivalent of the FBI here in the U.S. And when I walked into the office, in addition to dozens of government and military intelligence officials, my parents were there. And it was this moment that was indescribably emotional, one that many people thought would never happen. And for me and us, a breathtaking display of God answering prayers.
So there's laughter and there's tears and there's prayers of Thanksgiving, and eventually there's a flight home and you land back in St. Louis and the party begins.
Party is a little bit of an interesting word. It was kind of this overwhelming situation, just one that you know, many people didn't expect would ever happen. And after I had been home for just a little bit, and it was kind of determined that I was relatively okay, there were some humorous moments. My brother, Paul, who's just a year and a half younger than me, I remember he said to me, this was like the night I got home. He said, you were in solitary confinement for a month. You better be able to drop down and do 200 push-ups right now. No problem. Right? And one of my sisters, Stephanie, she has a close friend named Daniela, who's a family friend of ours. And Stephanie said to me that night, hey, you know, when you went missing, Daniela said, she told us that she said to God that I am going to church every day until Sam comes home. And my brother, Paul, was standing there, the same brother who made the comment of push-ups. And he goes, oh, really? That's interesting. I told God I wasn't going to church until Sam came home. And so they had kind of covered both bases there, but there were these humorous moments, and just so grateful that we were able to have those humorous moments.
So both Daniela and your brother made their commitments in their own faith walk to either go to church or to be repulsed by it. So those are two people working to get you out. You also had the Pope working to get you out. You had a guy named President Trump working to get you out. You had NGOs all around the United States, in Syria and around the world, working to get you out. And ultimately, it is, I think it's probably the most miraculous part of your story of how you got out, because it's none of the big names that ultimately broke you free.
One thing I'll quickly mention is that one of the most overwhelming things for me after coming home and in the wake of this has been learning about all of the people who were involved in this case. And it's from people who love me to people who had no idea who I was, and everywhere in between. And it's now 4.5 years later, and I'm still saying thank you to people. I'm still learning about someone who made a phone call or said a prayer or talked to someone, whatever it might have been. And that's truly been overwhelming. And as you mentioned, the Catholic Church was involved, the U.S. government was involved, nonprofits, private sector, all these different angles. But when I was trapped on the inside, I had no idea about anything that was happening on the outside. So all of this I learned later. And essentially, the news of my disappearance was learned through me going dark. I was always very good about keeping in touch, especially if I was more of an unstable place. And I'd communicated that I was going to be in Syria for just a few days. And when that time passed and people weren't hearing from me, they began to worry. And my father works in civil engineering. My mother's a registered nurse turned educator. Both of them are smart people and have had relative success in their respective fields. But they're an average family from middle America. They had no idea what to do when they're somewhat missing. So they started working with the U.S. government and had kind of a roller coaster experience with them. But the government communicated two key things to my family. The first, they said, we strongly recommend that you keep this out of the news. Don't let the press get a hold of this, because if they do, Sam's captors feeling that type of pressure might just kill him.
Right.
And the second thing they said was, you should really manage your expectations, because we have no diplomatic or economic ties with Syria. There may not be a whole lot we can do here to help. And it was about 3 weeks later, my younger sister, Stephanie, who was 25 years old at the time living in Nashville, she particularly became entirely overwhelmed with everything that was happening. And she decided that she needed to call someone and talk to them about it and just blow off some steam, and which was against the recommendation of the government. And so she decided that she was going to call her former college roommate, who is actually coincidentally also named Stephanie. And there's this phone call between the Stephanies. And as the story goes, it's, you know, hey, how you doing? And my Steph says, well, actually, things aren't very good. And she goes on to explain, you know, my brother's been missing for weeks. Nobody's heard from him, working with all of these officials and agencies, and nobody's been able to help. We're really scared. And roommate Steph, of course, shocked to hear something like this, but she says all the right things, offers her full support. And at the end of the call, as the story goes, roommate Steph says, hey, if there's anything I can do, just let me know. My Steph responded almost jokingly or sarcastically. She just said, well, unless you know someone who knows Assad, the Syrian president, please just pray. And roommate Steph said, wait, let me call you back. And it turned out that roommate Steph is Lebanese, and her uncle is good friends with a man named General Abbas Ibrahim, who heads Lebanon's internal security, who had went on to mediate my release. And so when my sister called her college roommate, she didn't really even know that she was Lebanese. She didn't know Lebanon was close to Syria. It wasn't strategic. She was just calling a friend at the time when she desperately, you know, needed support. And so this is a situation where the FBI, the CIA, President Trump, the Pentagon, Pope Francis was involved, as you mentioned, Russian intelligence, Middle East NGOs, private sector security companies were all struggling to be effective. But my sister's college roommate could identify a path to get an American hostage released from Syria.
I'm purposely letting the silence hang out there.
Yeah.
It's a stunning story, man. When you hear about this, what do you do with this information? Not only the heartache of your siblings and your parents and those who loved you and what they went through. It's different than your pain, but only by a little bit, because a parent is only as happy as their least happy child, and they know you're not well at that point, so they feel that pain directly. And your sister Steph feels that pain directly. And so now you're hearing this miraculous story. Like, what does that do within you?
At the beginning, I was genuinely just confused. I was trying to put all the pieces together, trying to figure it out. And there was this moment when we were still in the office of General Security in Lebanon. And the roommate Steph's uncle had come with my parents to Lebanon, and he was in the office. And I, just a few minutes after reuniting with my parents, my dad was saying to me, "It's like, do you remember Stephanie's roommate in college?" And I remember having two responses to that. I said, first, no, not really. I had been in Asia the whole time. I just didn't really know. And the second thing I responded with, I said, "And why are we talking about that right now? Like why are we talking about, and why did you bring Stephanie's roommate's uncle with you?" I was confused. I didn't understand. And so then I put the pieces together, and it put so much into perspective. And sometimes people today will ask me questions like, "Do you get your sister a special Christmas gift every year?" Or sometimes
forget people your even sister, man. It's the roommate Stephanie is the one that deserves the big bucks on this thing.
Yeah, and I agree. And it's funny, people will say, "So did you marry roommate Steph?" And there's been a lot of these kind of humorous, fun moments, but it really just puts so much into perspective. And for me, I don't feel as much survivor's guilt, so to speak, as I feel more survivor's responsibility.
Awesome.
I feel like this experience was, and the peaceful conclusion was given to me for a reason, and feel a real responsibility to do positive good with it.
Sam, what do you do with this message going forward? You have been saved through miraculous connections and great fortune. You're home. You're back with your family. I'm visiting with you right now. You're healthy and handsome and doing great in life. As a survivor's responsibility, what do you want to do with the stories you look ahead?
Well, actually, when I first came home, a couple of weeks later, COVID hit, and it was like isolation 2.0. There were national news networks who were bringing on prisoners of war and former hostages to talk about that feeling of being trapped. And so I actually spent a lot of COVID kind of digesting this, reflecting, putting things into context, trying to figure out what can be pulled from this that can be useful and something I'll probably be reflecting on forever.
Right.
But where I'm at right now is when I speak, there's still a lot of disorientation for me today, and I'm still processing many of these experiences. And sometimes I feel like the best thing I can offer is to recommend having a resourceful sister, which is important, but my primary theme is I talk about uncertainty. And essentially, I was pushed to a point of overwhelming uncertainty, truly life or death. But through that, I learned some things that have helped me, and some things that I think can help all of us when we're facing uncertainty in our own personal and professional lives.
For those who are trapped today, and I don't mean those in Syria specifically, but for those who are trapped in a relationship or the lack of one, or physically or financially, or they're busted down and mad spiritually, they made that promise with God, "Until I get this thing, I'm not going back. I don't trust you anymore." What's your encouragement to those who are in that confinement right now, that prison right now?
We could be held hostage by anything. Alcohol, drugs, illness, relationships, finances, and things you just mentioned, but the way that we embrace and manage those challenges, I think that defines who we become. And from where we begin, again, I think a lot about what I sometimes characterize as the sine curve of life. And maybe some of us remember trigonometry, that sine curve, the never-ending up and down radio wave. And I think that when we're at the top and things are going well, it's important to have humility and awareness and gratitude, but nothing deeply good emerges from the top. It's always at the bottom of the curve when facing our biggest challenges, when all the growth happens. And so I would say to anyone in the situation that you outlined, I believe and have found that when we feel the most lost, we often have the best chance for a huge breakthrough.
Sam Goodwin, I think you have one of the most remarkable stories that I'm aware of. I love your heart. I love your faith. I love your joy. I love your passport stamped to the max. And I love the fact that you want to use these life stories to better others now. It's a great calling. We have 7 questions that get Tether, all of our global travelers together as one. We call them the Live Inspired 7. So Goodwin, buckle up, buddy. Here we go. Question number one is, what's been the most impactful book you've ever read?
Potentially, I would say Into the Wild.
Well, that kid didn't come back, man. You did.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
What was it about Into the Wild that you found so moving?
The adventure, and sometimes I say the best advice that I've ever been given is that the quickest way to be unhappy is to live our lives and make decisions based on other people's judgments. And I think that just the complete kind of embracing that and doing what he wanted to do is really powerful.
It's pretty bold. What's one positive characteristic or one trait that you possessed as a little boy growing up in St. Louis, Missouri, that you wish you exhibited as brilliantly today?
Gosh, I would maybe say curiosity. I try to be as curious as I can, but I think that childhood curiosity is really tough to replicate.
If your home caught fire and all living things and people are out and you have an opportunity of running in and grabbing one item, what's that one thing you would grab and come safely outside with?
I have all of pictures and videos that I've ever taken in my life on an external hard drive. So I would probably grab that.
If you could sit on a bench on a gorgeous day in any country of your choice and have a long conversation with anyone living or deceased, the primary question is, who do you want to be seated next to? But because you're such a global traveler, the follow-up is, and where specifically will you be seated? So on this bench, who do you want to have next to you and where will you be?
I don't think that I could answer without saying Jesus, but I'll go beyond that. I would say kind of going to the other end of the spectrum, and this may be a little bit controversial, but I would be interested in having a conversation with Adolf Hitler. That's who I would want to sit with and try to understand what was the mindset. I'd be really interested in that.
We've had a lot of Jesus seaters and a lot of MLK and a lot of other great leaders. This is by far the first time we've ever heard someone who's just known for their profound evil ways. Tell me specifically what it is about that mindset that you want to unpack and better understand.
I just don't understand how someone can be that evil. And I wonder if by better understanding it, it can help us to eradicate that and help address it better in our society today.
Well, we keep thinking, or at least I'll own this autobiographically. I keep thinking the world has made them its mistake. Thank God we'll never do that again. And yet, if you follow closely what's happening all over the world for all time, throughout all of history, we keep stepping in the same footprints again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And so the evil that was in the mid-1940s, it's on the horizon. We don't know her name or his name. We don't know where they're going to come from, but the evil is always on the horizon. So the idea of being able to unpack it in order to eradicate it seems to me to make a lot of sense.
That's where my head's at. And we see these never again moments continuing, whether it's in World War II or Rwanda. It goes on and on.
What's the best advice that you've ever received?
Interesting. I was just kind of mentioning that. And I think it's to not care what other people think. The quickest way to be unhappy is to live our lives and make decisions based on other people's judgments.
If you could go back to Niagara University, head up north on a nice snowy day and whisper some wisdom to yourself at age 20, what would you tell yourself to do?
I would say it gets better.
Gosh, man. Good advice, even though it's going to go through 2 months of agony to get better, but it will get better. Yeah. Sam Goodwin, my friend, it has been said that all great people can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How would you like yours to read?
Gosh, I should have prepared this. I hope to be remembered as someone who had a story to tell and had a positive impact on the people around him.
Sam Goodwin traveled the world, encountered the best and the worst of humanity, had a story to tell, told it well, and reminded us that we get to choose the kind of impact we have on others. Sam, I want to thank you for telling that story, for writing that story down, for sharing that as a speaker, and for honoring those who might still be held captive with the life you lead today. It's a beautiful story, man.
I appreciate it. And I have written it down, and I have a book that's available for pre-order now and will be on sale later this year in September 2024. It's been a labor of love, but it's been a challenge and a rewarding process.
Well, the book is called Saving Sam. It's a beautiful book. You'll enjoy the read. The man I just interviewed is named Sam Goodwin. My name is John O'Leary, and today is your day, my friends. Live inspired.
My friends, I am obviously so impressed and so in awe of Sam Goodwin's resilience, his courage, his faith, his coolness, his joy in the face of immense adversity. If you enjoy today's episode, you will love the conversation that I had a couple years back with my buddy, Captain Charlie Plum. As a former Navy fighter pilot, Charlie is a testament to the strength of the human spirit. Scheduled to be in his 75th and his final mission in Vietnam, Charlie's F-4 Phantom jet was shot down and he was captured. He then spent the next 2,103 days isolated and tortured in a North Vietnamese prisoner camp. Hear how purpose provides the strength to endure the unthinkable, and how despite the headwinds we face, the best indeed is yet to come. You're going to love Charlie Plum. He's a guy that I consider a mentor, a friend, and a guy that I look up to when I need inspiration. You can learn more about Charlie at episode 31 or by cruising over with me right now to johnolearyinspires.com/podcast. We'll have a link to it in today's show notes. My friends, as always, regardless of which nation you tune in from today, whatever country might be on the front of your passport, I want to thank you for being part of us in our community. We're grateful for you. We're grateful that you tune in, and we're grateful that you believe, like we do, that the foundation is firm. The headwind is indeed real, but the best is yet to come. So for this time and until next time, my name is John O'Leary. Today is your day. What a gift. Live inspired.
You know that Keeley Companies is all about fostering the world-class culture through their incredible cultural pillars. Well, it was time to add a seventh cultural pillar, Keeley Green. Guided by the mission to raise the sustainability standards by which they design, build, operate, and live, Keeley Green is dedicated to using a holistic approach to leave a positive impact on our environment, create a future that is sustainable for generations to come. In the words of Rusty Keeley, we are just getting started. You can learn more about that just getting started mentality and all the work they do by visiting my friends at Keeley Companies online at keeley.com. companies.com.